It's Wednesday, September 25th, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the official end of the White House press briefing is announced on Fox and Friends. Also, an effort to understand why there's a mistrust of the media and to rebuild that. It's a project that's centered in Casper, Wyoming. And what looks like the end of Antonio Brown's career in the NFL, how reporters approached the New England Patriots this past weekend. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our time is up today, but we're going to start with the latest coming from Washington, the move from House Democrats to start an impeachment inquiry, and the rest of us trying to figure out exactly what was said during that conversation between President Trump and the president of Ukraine, a memo, if you will, a five-page summary, maybe a transcript of that released this morning. Is details of the call are beginning to come out more. There have also been requests from Congress for the release of the whistleblower's full account of it. President says, yeah, maybe he did say some of those things that we've been hearing about all weekend. But the conversation and debates around those actions, they're not his fault.
Joe Biden and his son are corrupt. All right. But the fake news doesn't want to report it because they're Democrats. If that ever happened, if a Republican ever did what Joe Biden did, if a Republican ever said what Joe Biden said, they'd be getting the electric chair by right now. Look at the double standards. You people ought to be ashamed of yourself. And not all. We have some great journalists around, but you got a lot of crooked journalists. You're crooked as hell.
He said that in front of the president of Poland. That's a sitting president in the United States saying those things about the Fourth Estate, about the press that's there to keep him and hold him and other government officials accountable in front of the head of state of another country and in one of our allies.
This surprises you? I mean, it's... I mean,
okay,
he's been doing this...
Surprises, maybe not. Disappoints me even more? Yes.
Well, I'm kind of... I'm definitely not surprised and I'm done being disappointed.
Okay.
It's what he's done, not... We talk about it in terms of since he came down the golden escalator, but if you go back and you look at Donald Trump's relationship with the press, it has always been this way. So that's why I'm saying, are we surprised? Whether he's doing it in front of the president of Poland or he's doing it on Fox and Friends, this is what he's been doing.
It does have serious implications, though. I mean, I agree with everything Ernest said, but the problem is that people across the world parse what American leaders say very carefully. And we know for a fact that the president's consistent, constant running down of the press is having an impact overseas. It's kind of interpreted by dictators and thuggish leaders as kind of a green light to go ahead and do what they're doing because they think, well, if the president of the United States says it's okay, it's okay. So I think saying this in front of the leader of, shall we call it an emerging democracy, does have serious symbolic implications that then have actual real reverberations in real life for journalists in those
countries.
Setting
a tone and talking about what might be considered acceptable here to other countries.
Well, I mean, Kathy makes a very good point. That's where I think the problem comes. It's not who's saying it, it's the office that he holds and the authority that he brings, which causes the problems definitely for journalists, both definitely journalists who are operating in foreign countries where you don't have the protections of the First Amendment. That's a big problem. But even here within our own country, you have journalists who are now going out and they're covering stories where they being verbally attacked, definitely being attacked on social media. And we've had instances in which reporters have been physically attacked right here in this country because the president has given a green light for it to be open season on journalists.
Yes, yeah, I think Ernest makes a great point. He doesn't really inhabit his office. Donald Trump still thinks and acts like he's the Donald, mm-hmm. you know, the tabloid celebrity from New York for whom he likes reporters who are sycophantic to him and he doesn't like those who aren't. But now he's the president of the United States and his words are interpreted in an entirely different way. What for Donald Trump might be just convenient political rhetoric is being read as some kind of a message from on high by people who have spirals where their eyeballs should be. And we're seeing responses to that, both in this country, but also overseas, where, as I say, what American leaders say is important, it's interpreted, it's read in certain ways, and it has real impact on real lives.
And what we see with some of those leaders is that they're almost being treated as contestants on Celebrity Apprentice, where he's at the head of the board table on that. One of the things I noticed this morning with some of these developments in the last 36 hours or so is that there was kind of a warning to journalists not to right away pounce that this impeachment inquiry is going to be the beginning of a very long slog, pointing out that in the case of Bill Clinton, it was somewhere, I want to say, it was between 100 and 120 and 130 days from the launch of the inquiry to the completion and the idea of there not being a conviction coming out of the Senate, that we have, there's a lot to come here and to remain measured in that coverage.
Well, I think that the difference here is that you have a president who enjoys being attacked and will use that to his advantage. He will play on the people's emotions, and he's done that all along. You have a more robust social media environment today.
Well,
than
there
you
wasn't
had.
One
then
in 1998.
There was very little, if anything. I mean, people were just understanding email at that
right.
point. So
I mean, the Googles were barely even a thing if they were.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've got that as a backdrop mm-hmm. And as a tool that's going to be used both by Donald Trump and his supporters and by the Democrats. So you've got that going on. And you have an upcoming presidential election. I mean, we are closer to the election now than we were when Bill Clinton was going through this. So you've got all of those dynamics at play here. And I'm pretty sure Nancy Pelosi is looking at all of that and going, okay, how do I maneuver the House through this process while having to also understand how this is playing out
and
in
how
the larger
her,
context.
And how she attempts to hold on to power as Speaker. There was an interesting interview this morning with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about
Ocasio-Cortez.
Thank you very much. Talking about how she is also kind of looking at and backing other candidates who are much more progressive than the Democrats who are in the House right now, and how Nancy Pelosi is also trying to figure out the math in order to keep her caucus together, right. too, and build that support. There's an interesting piece that's on our links blog about this. And Kathy, as you bring up that idea of the international perspective, a journalist from the Australian edition of The Guardian was writing about her first experience seeing a Donald Trump press conference beginning to end without there being any editing, without there being the chopping up into the 20-second soundbite. And she makes the argument actually that we may be doing our audiences a disservice because perhaps we're making him look more credible than he is when we take those snippets and put those out there without the full context of the ranting, the raving, the rambling that takes away any kind of sense of coherence. We're actually putting coherence in.
I thought that was a really interesting piece. I always say, having covered many, many press conferences, mm-hmm. that I would never want to watch a press conference live because I want to wait for the poor schlub who I used to be, to have to tell me the 10 most interesting things and put it into something that I can read in 30 seconds mm-hmm. as opposed to sit there for a half an hour
right.
or more.
You sat through it so they didn't have to.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it is true that a lot of what you do when you do journalism is drain out the irrelevant stuff and give your readers just what they need to know. In this case, her argument is that that stuff is not irrelevant, that that it says something about the person that people need to know. And I thought it was very interesting. I mean, it goes completely against the grain, I think, mm-hmm. for what journalists are trained to do. But I think we've talked about other examples on this show where the kind of standard trappings of how you cover a president or a public figure really do work to Donald Trump's advantage, because you use certain rhetorical turns and you write with a certain tone and you include things and don't include other things that Trump's critics would say, well, those are important to include. But they're not the kind of things we usually write about as journalists. Right. So it's another example of how Donald Trump has completely flummoxed all of us.
Well, as I was reading that, Ernest, I was thinking about conversations that we've been having both on the air and off the air about how and when we bring Trump and his antics into this program. And this goes all the way back to the campaign, where we talked about, like, with every one of those campaign news conferences where he would say something so outlandish that we couldn't believe it. And we're like, well, we could spend 28 minutes and 30 seconds every week talking about this. We're not going to.
Right.
Unless
right.
it reaches the value of newsworthiness, we're not going to.
But I think he's redefined what that is. I mean, I really do think that he's redefined what is the value that comes from the statements that he makes. Because we can't, and as journalists, we can't seem to help ourselves to say, okay, that was just so outrageous, we have got to run that. And then we run it, and then we're down that rabbit hole again, where I keep going back to, what is the policy? What is being
because
done and what's not
being
done?
Because what we're actually doing is taking the lead and taking the bait that's being put out
absolutely,
there for
absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The White House has made a decision, too, that it's really satisfied with the way the president is handling the messaging on its policies. And where else to make that announcement that official press briefings from the briefing room in the White House are over than on Fox and Friends? Here's Stephanie Grisham on that program Monday morning.
So is this the new press briefing? Before we saw all of his press secretaries with, you know, in front of the podium.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Spicer, they made fun of him on Saturday Night Live because you'll never have that moment, because no longer are we doing that, right?
There's not right now. I mean, ultimately, if the president decides that it's something we should do, we can do that. But right now, he's doing just fine. And to be honest, the briefings had become a lot of theater. And I think that a lot of reporters were doing it to
get famous.
They really
I
were.
Mean, yeah, they're writing books now. I mean, they're all getting famous off of this presidency. And right. so I think it's great what we're doing now.
Okay, so that was 30 seconds of morning television with so much to unpack in there. The first thing that caught my mind, that caught my ear, and the first thing that we just played there, starting with the choice of pronouns that we heard Ainsley Earhart from Fox use. This is what we do now. Not this is what you're doing now. This is what the White House is doing now. The use of the first person pronoun from somebody from Fox and Friends.
And that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, anyone who's watched that show, it's always been kind of a shockingly Homerish show. For it, you know, very overt about it. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's shocking if you look at it in the larger context of what the media has done, but certainly not shocking in the context of Fox.
Okay, so next thing there. We probably can't argue with the point that the White House press briefings had ostensibly turned into theater. We have talked about that many a times, talking about some of the statements or speeches, say, that Jim Acosta made in the guise of asking a question, right? And talking about some of that grandstanding and that all about me in that moment. But Brian Kilmeade literally finishes the sentence for her, doesn't give her the chance to talk about it being theater. He basically finishes the sentence.
Well, he's mansplaining.
Is that what it is? Because my other thought, too, was he's talking about all these people who are writing books. And
she was the one that wrote up the part of, who brought up the point about writing the books. But he sort of let her down the primrose path.
Well, and the first analysis, if you will, that I saw of this 30 seconds was from Anderson Cooper, and he did a ridiculous segment about this. And he followed that up with a full screen, I think, of the 7 or 8 books that have been written about the Trump presidency by people who are on Fox News.
Right.
And the people who are profiting off of the term of this president.
Right.
Okay, so then Kilmeade mentions a little bit later into this interview, so a little bit later than what I just played for you here, but he talks about how wonderful it is that Stephanie Grisham is in this position and how excited he is to see a woman in this prominent of a position.
Didn't we just have one?
Yeah, my next thought was exactly that. Not only did we just have a woman, right? Sarah Sanders was the person who held it before her. What about Dana Perino, who was one of George W. Bush's press secretaries? Right. And then Dee Dee Myers. So I was going through and looking to see how many women have held that role. There have been three. There have now been four. And three of them have been for Republican presidents, two of them for Donald Trump.
Right, right. Here's the thing.
And wait, can I add one more layer to that Sunday? Two of them were on the Fox News payroll. Sarah Sanders and Dana Perino are also now on the Fox News payroll. Okay, now go ahead.
But the larger question here is that the reason they're saying this is because it was theater. But when you honestly look at it, who's the best spokesperson for Donald Trump?
Fox News.
No, Donald Trump.
Oh, okay.
Donald Trump is the guy.
Okay.
And why should I give airtime to one of my subordinates when I can have it?
I think that's exactly right. Yeah. And frankly, I do not really mourn the loss of the White House briefing, having sat through many of them.
So talk about that, because that's an experience none of us have had. And frankly, no one else who's ever been on this program has.
Well, I think, I think there's no question that it has become theater. And I think most of the reporters don't like it because, and interestingly enough, Mike McCurry, who was the press secretary for Bill Clinton, has said publicly numerous times that he regrets having made the decision to put it on air. And I think he is right because it became then this sort of set piece where you couldn't actually have a candid back and forth with a member of the administration. You were on TV and your editors were watching. And oftentimes, the bosses back in the office would be saying, oh, make sure you ask this question, make sure you ask this question.
Which
and
probably that's why, became even more so in the age of PDAs, of the idea of the Palm Pilot, then the BlackBerry, then the iPhone.
Absolutely. And so I think what it did, it really damaged something that's very important for the press corps, which is the follow-up question. Because if you had a list of six questions that your boss was insisting you ask, you could not be listening to what your colleague had just asked and the non-answer that was given and follow up on it. So hooray, I say, I demand to be denied access. I think what will happen is that conversations will continue between reporters and members of the administration, but they will do so off camera. And I think that will be a much healthier environment for everybody.
Yeah, the only downside I see to that, which I agree, I think that's what's going to happen, is that you're already starting to see it.
Yeah.
You have more and more people who are willing to give information but not be identified for fear of retaliation or whatever. And that news media have been moving away from that in light of some of the things that happened during the George W. Bush administration when it came to unidentified sources. And now you're starting to see it move back in the other direction.
So that's actually a really good segue to the next thing that I wanted to talk about, which was a piece that was published in the New York Times, which was actually really just the spoken remarks that paper's publisher had made at a speech at Brown University much earlier in the week. I believe it was on Monday. And one of the things that was buried deep into that address was what has become news this week, that a New York Times reporter 2 years ago was about to be arrested in Egypt. And whereas in the past, newspapers would be tipped off to this with the support of our White House, of the government and the administration to try and free people or to, even before an arrest could happen, to get them to a point of safety. In this case, it was a staffer who kind of made that call on the QT and was actually on quiet and not wanting anyone to know. And was doing so to make sure that he was on or she was on the side of good. because they wanted to make sure that reporter was okay. But the Trump administration didn't want that to happen.
Yes, according to the publisher, the New York Times publisher, Sulzberger's remarks, that government employee told the Times that he or she was feared that reprisals, that, you know, job loss for having tipped the paper off that the reporter was about to be arrested. So this, you know, I think this gets back to the topic a little bit we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, the United States has for all of my life been a beacon of press freedom, and we are the model that the rest of the world looks to. And increasingly, I find myself when I'm talking to journalists from overseas saying, well, what can you tell us about what it's like to work in a hostile environment? Because we need to learn something from you. It's really unfortunate, and I think it's global. I think there's a global war against free speech, and some days I feel like the United States is on the wrong side.
When the president makes those comments about fake news, like the ones that we heard about a little bit earlier in this program, his message is getting out there to his base that we can't be trusted.
It's what you don't report. It's when the stories are... It's when the stories are positive towards conservative ideas, they get buried or they get ignored.
We're so tied up in these sensational gotcha issues, and we're not paying attention to real matters.
The media is so intent on being the first person to have the story out that accuracy and verification gets pushed to the wayside.
So those clips are all part of a promotional video for a program underway in Casper, Wyoming, put on by the Society of Professional Journalists. It's designed to rebuild trust in the news media, in large part through education about how the media works. Kathy, this is something that you and I have been talking about a lot this summer, trying to break through to uncooperative or unresponsive audiences by creating a sense of what we do, how we do it, and why we do it.
Yeah, and I think social media has really complicated that for all of us. It's complicated it in several ways. One was alluded to by one of the speakers, you know, the emphasis on speed. And I think the other thing that a lot of outside readers don't understand is that there's been the digital disruption has really had an impact on newspaper revenues. So that means fewer reporters doing those jobs. So it's, you know, newsrooms are under stress. But I think in addition to that, you have, you know, everybody's crazy uncle Joe's tweet is given on a Facebook feed the same treatment as something from the Columbia Missourian or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And a lot of readers don't see the difference. And so what we do gets mixed up with what non-professionals are doing on social media. And so I think it's really important to get out there and say to people, this is what a professional media organization looks like, and this is what we do. And yes, sometimes you're going to be mad at us, but we're always going to pick up the phone. Mm-hmm. You always know how to reach us. We're not a bot.
So what makes this project special, the way this is being carried out and how it's being
I think
made?
I think it's special in a way that journalists are going out and actually engaging, doing a lot of a public engagement in terms of trying to not only tell people here's how we operate, but to also listen to their stories and their opinions about why they feel this way about the news media. I think the other thing that we in the media have issue with is, and you alluded to this in terms of social media, we need to understand that people go to news media in different ways now. They don't get it on their front lawn, or they don't sit down and watch the 5:30 and 6 o'clock news. They're getting it constantly from their phones and through their apps and that sort of thing. And that we don't control the distribution model. Mm-hmm. That distribution model is now controlled by Google and Facebook and others. So when we put that content out there, we have to understand how people are actually getting it and what they're getting, and they can pick and choose. That's the other thing that I think we're finally starting to come to grips with, the fact that the way social media operates and the way people get the news has a direct impact on what they think about and what they trust.
So what besides money would it take to replicate something like this into an area like here? Like Casper, Wyoming was chosen because it is a very red state, that it's sparsely populated. What would it take to replicate, if we had all the money in the world to do that, what would it take to replicate something like that in some of our rural areas?
I think it takes time.
Yeah.
I mean, which is really, that is money. I mean, you're talking about sending people out into communities. And I do think it's very powerful. And I think more and more organizations are doing this. I know the Columbia Missourian has meetings, outreach with readers on a regular basis. And I do think it's very powerful. But we're fortunate at the University of Missouri that we have a lot of students mm-hmm. who are available to talk. But a lot of newsrooms are really short-staffed. So you have to make a decision. Are you going to cover the story that day, or are you going to go out and talk to some readers?
Okay, we have time for just a couple of quick hits before we go, if you will. Kathy, update us on what you and hundreds of other journalists across the country did this weekend. Tell us about Ask About Austin.
Yeah, well, we visited members of Congress, not to cover them, but to ask them for help. Austin Tice, a former Eagle Scout. He is an Eagle Scout. He's a former member of the U.S. Marine Corps, and he's a journalist who's been a hostage in Syria for 7 years. And everybody in the media, from Fox News to NPR and the New York Times, has been editorializing and writing about his case. And now we're asking members of Congress to join us, because, as I say, people overseas pay attention to what our leaders say, and we're hoping to get Austin home.
Okay, we don't need to know the details of the meetings, but did you get some support on some level from our local legislators?
I was very pleased that all of the members of our local delegation, all of whom are Republicans, gave me a considerable amount of time. So I got a sympathetic hearing, and I was happy to talk to them.
Took the meetings. That's the first step. Okay, Antonio Brown, cut by the Patriots. Coach Bill Belichick was none too pleased with this question from reporter Dana Jacobson.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, what was the final straw with Antonio Brown?
Yeah, we're focused on the Jets today.
Thank you, Coach.
So the freeze frame on the end of that video showed that he gave her quite the icy stare. That was an image that went viral this week. She says she was doing his job. He said he was doing his. There's nothing to read into it there. They were just doing their jobs and asking.
Yeah, I mean, she felt it was her responsibility to ask the question. She asked it. Bill Belichick does what Bill Belichick does, which is he doesn't answer. If he doesn't want to answer a question, he just won't answer it. This is nothing new for him. The Patriots as a team and an organization has had very little to say about Antonio Brown and their, you know, their relationship with him, short as it may be. And I know that there's some people on social media going back and forth about it and saying, well, you know, Bill wasn't professional and she shouldn't ask the question, but that's what you're going
to do. She asked the question everybody wanted to answer. Well, and so, and as a Steelers fan, I'll just say, Bill Belichick told you so.
Okay, there you go. Well, we are out of time for today. You can read more about each of our topics on our links blog. That's on both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch or listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions. See previews of what we'll be talking about next time and more. It's going to be the middle of October when we're back with you, so you're going to want to check in. Thanks to RJIs, Travis McMillan, Aaron Hay, and Tim Pilcher. Have a good week.